The third jewel, the Sangha, the fellowship of the Buddha's disciples. What we call Buddhism begins with one man sitting in meditation and resolving to discover the means to bring an end to all earthly sorrow, to penetrate into the deepest and most compelling mystery of the universe. Equally, however, it begins with men and women all over the world and in every century for the last 2,500 years sitting in meditation and resolving to work this same transformation in their own being. Buddhism begins with the faith that the human mind, on its own, is capable of releasing a concentration of energy sufficient to break through all the limitations of conditioned existence. It begins with the faith that the barriers of fear and hatred and greed and ignorance that keep people locked away in their own little worlds can be dismantled by the agency of wisdom and compassion, and that these qualities may gradually be cultivated by any reasonable man or woman in the world. What the Buddha achieved, all beings can achieve. All those who follow in the footsteps of the Buddha are part of the Sangha, the fellowship of those who tread the Buddhist path. The Buddha's first 60 disciples were mostly from the city of Varanasi. They were well-to-do young men like himself, and like very many people today, secure from the want and hardship that has characterized the human experience of the vast majority of mankind throughout history. All of them gained full enlightenment within weeks. Sending them forth into the world, the Buddha was at pains to emphasize that there was no essential difference between their attainment and his own. He also made it clear that the Sangha was not necessarily confined to the inhabitants of our own world.
Monks, you know that I am free from all shackles, the shackles of human life, and the shackles of existence in the realms of heaven as well. You, monks, are likewise free from all shackles, whether human or divine. Go forth, monks, for the welfare and happiness of all beings, out of compassion for all, whether on earth, in heaven, or in hell. Teach the Dharma, which is good in its means as well as its ends, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Teach the letter of the Dharma and the spirit of it also.
In this way, the Sangha, the fellowship of the Buddha's disciples, began its long and extraordinary journey down the centuries, finding wildly different forms wherever it went. So what was the justification for these developments? Did not the Buddha have time enough in his long life to lay down clearly and precisely how everyone should practice? The Buddha's insight involved letting go of the notion of a fixed and separate self. But paradoxically, this insight can be attained only by a real individual, someone who finds their own way, who stands on their own two feet, who thinks for themselves. In short, it can be attained only by someone who does not have to cling to something fixed, whether this is a fixed self or a fixed view, anything nailed down by an authority.
A monk or Brahmin who holds a philosophical viewpoint and secures himself to it, saying, "This alone is true, all else is false," will become a dogmatist and will fall to disputing. Likewise, one who secures himself to the view of rejecting all views will be a dogmatist, and he too will fall to disputing. Myself, I'm not a dogmatist, but an analyst. The well-instructed disciple sees the conditioned nature of all things. He becomes dispassionate to all things, subject to dependent origination. His heart thus freed, he takes no sides, and disputes with none.
Though the Buddhist position is no position, it is not a rejection of positions. It is not nihilism or skepticism. It is a freedom of the heart from views. Thus, what is called in Buddhism right view must always be held as something that is actually useful. If it is not useful in terms of attaining the goal of Buddhism, which is freedom from views, then it becomes wrong view. A Buddhist position or view that is taken as an end in itself and becomes dogma is no longer a Buddhist position. The extraordinarily rich and audacious developments of the Dharma down the centuries are a reflection of this important principle. The Dharma as a raft. The Buddha was fond of describing the Dharma as a raft. It is in the nature of a raft that it is built out of whatever lays to hand. It is made up for the purpose of crossing over a river, but when one gets to the other side, one naturally discards it. The whole principle of building a raft for a certain purpose remains true, whatever the shape of the raft. But clearly, different cultures are going to develop different technologies of raft building. Indeed, the ways one can build the raft are as many as there are individuals going about it. And when the raft starts turning into a rather shishy houseboat, then individuals need to appear who will get back to the real point of it all. Of course, the Dharma is not literally something one uses to go somewhere. The principle may also be illustrated by saying that the Dharma is like a piano. Practicing it involves the cultivation of skills for the achievement of a certain aim. One practices scales, exercises, and studies, developing a full mastery of keyboard skills in order to play music, to perform not just the right notes in the right order, but the music itself. The music is the whole point of playing the piano. This musicality depends on the acquisition of technique, but at the same time, it depends on the abandoning of technique as an end in itself. Instead of oneself playing the music, it should be the music playing through oneself, through one's technique. One can make all sorts of pretty sounds, but it isn't necessarily music. This seems obvious, and yet with life, a different attitude tends to come into play. However individuals go about it, the music tends to elude them, either because they don't bother to practice anything at all, or else they get stuck with the technique. They get stuck with being a Buddhist, with achieving Buddhist goals. The purpose of the practice of Buddhism is always beyond Buddhism. The aim is to develop an intuitive appreciation of the whole pattern, the whole point of what one has been engaged in all one's life. So this is why the Dharma very often has a technical flavor to it. It is a matter of developing skills. The spiritual friendship of the Sangha. Because the Dharma is not an incontrovertible revelation from above, there is no one telling Buddhists what to do. However, this leaves them with the responsibility of somehow choosing their own way. The basis upon which they can do this is provided by the Sangha. Human individuals are said by psychologists to be the product, in one way or another, of their association with other people, starting with their parents. Their emotional lives, the whole direction and quality of their lives, is bound up with other people. And there are certain people that one specifically chooses to be influenced by. These are one's friends. The importance of the Sangha is based upon the principle that the development of a human being is based upon their choice of friends. Therefore, a Buddhist chooses to associate particularly with people on the basis of a common commitment to the Dharma. This is spiritual friendship. Mutual kindness and appreciation and care between friends is, as the Buddha once said to his attendant Ananda, not just a very important part of the spiritual life, but the whole of the spiritual life. In short, the Sangha is the prime means by which the Dharma is realized.
I do not see any other single condition by means of which the Noble Eightfold Path can arise and can be perfected except by this spiritual friendship.
The primary models of this ideal are represented by the Buddha himself and his attendant Ananda, and by Shariputra and his boyhood friend, Moggallana. Ananda was celebrated for his kind heart. Shariputra for his wisdom, and Moggallana for his formidable psychic powers developed out of his mastery of meditation. All three had very different temperaments. Indeed, the more deeply individuals develop, the more unique they become, and the more they appreciate the uniqueness of others. In the Buddha's day, joining the Sangha involved a simple declaration from the heart. Preserved over and over again in the oral records is an expression of commitment that occurs whenever a critical depth of conversion is attained after a teaching has been delivered.
Excellent Lord, excellent Lord. It is as if one were to set up that which had been overturned, or to disclose that which was hidden, or were to point out the way to a lost traveller, or were to carry a lamp into a dark place that they who had eyes might see forms. Even so has the Blessed One expounded the Dharma in many ways. I go for refuge to the Blessed One, to the Dharma, and to the order of monks. Let the Blessed One accept me as a disciple from this day forth, as long as life shall last.
Come, monk, live the spiritual life for the utter cessation of suffering.
The Vinaya, the rule of the monks. The Buddha's Sangha was by no means the only spiritual community in ancient India to which one might belong, and defectors from other communities would be put on probation for a few months. Otherwise, the new disciple would have his head shaved by a monk called Upali, who was described as being foremost in the Vinaya or discipline. This was because at the same time as being tonsured, the new member of the Sangha would be introduced to the rule of the Sangha, the Vinaya. The original Sangha was no different in its way of life from other communities of wandering mendicants. Basic rules such as celibacy, a simple lifestyle, and alms gathering were the established practice of the day. They signaled one's commitment to an ideal beyond worldly interests, and gave one the freedom to pursue it. Once a month, the monks would come together, make confession of any slip-ups, and make a declaration of their shared ideals, known as the Pratimoksha. This is one very early example of such a declaration.
Forbearance is the highest asceticism. Nirvana is the ultimate goal, say the enlightened ones. No one who truly goes forth from the world harms another. To refrain from evil, to strive to do good, to purify the mind, this is the dispensation of the Buddhas. Not to speak evil, not to hurt, to observe the Pratimoksha, to eat sparingly, to abide in seclusion from the world, to develop positive mental states through meditation. This is the dispensation of the Buddhas.
As his followers became more numerous, the Buddha had to pronounce upon a growing variety of ways that the monks sought to evade the simple discipline of their life as monks. Thus he had to specify precisely what kind of possessions were appropriate for monks to have, and precisely when food was to be eaten by, which was midday. After his death, these pronouncements became a detailed catalogue of rules to cover every possible loophole. There are 220 rules, by no means all of which were actually instituted by the Buddha. All schools observe the same rules, though some emphasize the importance of observing the letter of them, and others are more inclined to observe the spirit. The fact that they include injunctions forbidding monks to have sexual intercourse with animals gives some idea of their comprehensiveness. Properly observed, they are not taken as ends in themselves, and allowances always made for individuals. They are like rules of grammar and syntax. To those who communicate very effectively and sensitively without them, the rules of grammar seem to be arcane and pointless. But for those who actually learn to abide by them, and sometimes decide not to, the rules make what they are trying to do much easier. There are, of course, no punishments for breaking the rules. The worst transgressions of the code are indulging in sexual intercourse, taking life, theft, and boasting of spiritual attainments. Such an offense is called a defeat, and simply means that the perpetrator rules themselves out of being a monk or nun during their life. Otherwise, it is possible to leave the order temporarily up to 7 times and still be reordained. The development of schools, the Theravada. Originally, monks and nuns were supposed to stay in one place only during the months of the monsoon. The saying went that water is pure that flows, the monk is pure that goes. However, inevitably, some of them found reasons not to move on when the rain stopped, and so monasteries were gradually established as temporary lodgings turned into more permanent ones. As monks settled in a particular locality, and as the Sangha spread into more remote areas, disagreements quite easily turned into separate schools. This was no problem. The Buddha had specifically allowed for such diversity, particularly by his refusal to allow his teachings to be cemented into a single authoritative language, and by his refusal to nominate a successor or structure of authority. The Dharma was always meant to be adapted to the needs of individuals, not policed or preserved in amber. Each school had its own collection of discourses and teachings. The scriptures of the Theravada school, the Buddhism which today flourishes in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia, constitute the only one of these collections to have survived in their entirety. The sutras, or discourses, preserved by the Theravada are known collectively as the Pali Canon, being written in the ancient language of Pali, and they provide us with most of our knowledge of the historical Buddha. The speciality of the Theravada is the Abhidharma, which means the higher teaching. This began as an exercise in sorting out the Buddha's teachings, but it turned into an exhaustively detailed analysis of the most minute components of all perceptual experience. It was a remarkable psychological investigation developed out of the Buddha's simple analysis of the self into form, feeling, perception, choice, and consciousness. For example, instead of half-consciously picking up a chocolate and eating it, an Abhidharmist would observe particular qualities of material form and try to distinguish the various aspects of sensory perception of them going on, and the recognition of them, and the complex of feelings associated with them, together with the volition to engage with them, and all this in conjunction with consciousness, and thus awareness of the whole process. In this way, one was supposed to develop insight into the composite and impermanent nature of all things. The expansion of Buddhism into an international religion began in the 3rd century BC, when the Indian emperor, Ashoka, converted to Buddhism after he became sickened at his own particularly brutal conquest of part of eastern India. The result was what seems to be the first social welfare policy in history. He built hospitals, looked after the poor, and even had convicts treated humanely. What he did not do was to make Buddhism the state religion, and he insisted on complete tolerance of all religions. However, Buddhist embassies were sent abroad as far as Egypt and Macedonia, and both Sri Lanka and Burma were introduced to Buddhism at this time. His rock edicts, which he had carved into rock faces or on massive pillars throughout his empire, many of which survive to this day, record a remarkable attitude in a ruler of his time.
I am never completely satisfied with my work or my vigilance in carrying out public affairs. Such work as I accomplish contributes to discharging the debt that I owe to all living beings.
Ashoka also built stupas, monumental reliquaries, in all the places associated with the Buddha's life, which had become places of pilgrimage and objects of reverence or worship, to stimulate a more heartfelt response to the Buddha's teachings. This did not make him into a god, then or now. Images of the Buddha. There were no images of the Buddha to worship at this time. The nearest artists had got to depicting the Buddha was in the form of a footprint, a parasol, a wheel, or a throne. This was the closest artists felt able to go in the direction of providing a focus for devotion. For actual images of the Buddha, we have to wait until the 1st century AD. However, out of these simple images and featureless stupas was to develop the richest tradition of religious art the world has ever seen. Once the apparent taboo against representations of the Buddha himself was broken, it was as if the Dharma had found a new language. The first flowering is represented by the burly figures of the Buddha from Mathura, near Agra, often with one hand raised in the gesture of reassurance and radiating regal presence. At about the same time, Greek-influenced figures from Gandhara, in modern Pakistan, showed him as more human, while the slightly later Gupta images confront us with even more spiritual refinement, and in the colossal figures carved into the cliffs of Central Asia, a transcendent majesty. As for the frescoes of the caves of Ajanta of the same period, these most clearly reveal a concerted attempt to render the teachings of Buddhism in terms of a single visual image. In future centuries and in other cultures, this was to be the main direction of Buddhist art. The first flowering of Buddhist art represents, in fact, a new development in Buddhism, concerned with an immediate response of the heart. There is no doubt that the Buddha himself was the subject of a great deal of devotion during his lifetime. When he was not actually there, one could practice a meditation called the recollection of the Buddha, which was, in effect, a form of visualization practice. It is meant to be an antidote to fear, and was therefore much resorted to in the era of persecution and invasion following the death of Ashoka. Out of the still depths of the concentrated mind, visions of the Buddha's radiant archetypal form displaced the dusty human appearance of the historical Buddha. Some visionaries even started to wonder if the austere old arahants amongst them could really be said to represent the Buddhist ideal. In fact, the seeds of the future development of Buddhism can be found within 100 years of the Buddha's parinirvana. This was when the first major schism in the Sangha took place, at the second council of the whole Sangha. The reason why it was a schism and not an amicable disagreement was because it concerned not philosophy, but the Vinaya, the monastic code. At the first council, Ananda had reported the Buddha's suggestion that the Sangha might abolish the minor and lesser rules when he was gone. But it had not occurred to him to ask the Buddha to be more specific. So the rules were left as they were. However, at the second council, a number of senior monks, who became known as the elders or staviras, wanted to add yet more rules, and their initiative was resisted by the greater number of those present, who became known as the Greater Community, or Mahasangha. To create a schism is one of the very worst things that a Buddhist can do. But in the end, monks in India came to be able to live peaceably in the same monasteries as those they disagreed with, even on fundamental philosophical issues, because their differences on questions of the monastic code remained quite trivial. The Theravada is the last remaining, though still very vigorous, offshoot of the Staviras. The Mahasangha gave rise eventually to the rest of the Buddhist world, the Buddhism of Tibet, China, Mongolia, Korea, Vietnam, and Japan, the Buddhism of Bodhisattvas, and ultimately Zen. This freely and richly proliferating movement eventually came to call itself, by the 4th century AD, the Mahayana, the Great Way, to distinguish itself from what is called the Hinayana, the lesser way of the descendants of the Staviras. The growth of the Mahayana, the great vehicle. 1. A deeper relevance to lay people. The Mahayana movement first of all aimed at making the Dharma a deeper relevance to lay people. Until recently, Dharma practice for lay people in the Theravada tradition was not considered a serious proposition. The best lay people could do was make offerings to the monks in the hope of a more favorable rebirth. For women, this would be rebirth as a man, as there have been no Theravadin nuns for a millennium. So the Theravada Sangha consists solely of monks or bhikkhus. The Mahayana Sangha, however, consists of all practicing Buddhists. The Buddha himself made it clear that being a monk did not in itself set one apart from ordinary folk, except in lifestyle. The core of the Sangha, the Arya Sangha, consisted not specifically in those of his followers who had adopted the mendicant lifestyle. It consisted at the very lowest level in what are called stream entrants. That is, those whose whole vision of things had shifted irrevocably so that there could be no falling away from their progress towards enlightenment. And of the Buddha's large lay following, a not insignificant number were members of this Arya Sangha, while many of the monks clearly were not. Indeed, by virtue of the criterion for membership, this Arya Sangha exists outside space and time altogether, and even outside Buddhism itself. It is probably feasible to attain to stream entry without ever having come across Buddhism at all, let alone having become a monk. This Sangha is the lifeblood of the Dharma, because it is only in the living experience of some level of real insight that the spirit of the Dharma can be renewed. It is in the way the Dharma is actually realized, whether in ourselves or in others, that it has any meaning for us whatsoever. Two, the Bodhisattva ideal. The second main principle of the Mahayana is its emphasis on compassion as the key to wisdom, and as embodied in the figure of the Bodhisattva, someone who dedicates himself not just to their own enlightenment, but to the enlightenment of all beings. The Buddha was a Bodhisattva himself before his enlightenment, and popular folk tales of the Buddha's previous lives, the Jataka stories, in which he appears as ordinary people, or even as animals, who yet perform heroic deeds, provided an early model for this idea. At the heart of the Bodhisattva principle is this dedicated striving for all sentient beings. The Bodhisattva vows to postpone his enlightenment until all beings are enlightened. There are different levels of Bodhisattva. At the highest level is a symbolic or idealized or archetypal kind of Bodhisattva. In the scriptures of the Theravada, the Pali canon, there is just one symbolic Bodhisattva called Maitreya. He is regarded as the Buddha to be. When all traces of the Dharma, as taught by Shakyamuni, have disappeared, he will appear to set forth the teachings once again. The Mahayana monks extended the concept of the Bodhisattva by coming up with further symbolic Bodhisattva figures who embody particular key qualities or concepts. One is Manjushri, the Bodhisattva who represents wisdom. He is pictured in art as a youthful figure carrying two important symbols, a book representing the development of reason beyond itself, and a sword to cut through the limitations of the rational mind. Another is Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva who represents compassion. He is often pictured with 1,000 arms, all stretching out to help sentient beings. In this way, a whole pantheon of deities arose representing different aspects of the Bodhisattva ideal. On the simplest level, by being such strong, clear images, they act as a focus for devotion. On a higher level, they are visualized in meditation, bringing to life the qualities they embody. One could say that they were products of the mind, but it would be more accurate to say that they are supposed to be emanations of the enlightened mind. The highest level of Bodhisattva is archetypal. The lowest level is the practicing Buddhist, the ordinary human being, who accepts the Bodhisattva ideal without having fully realized it. The practicing Buddhist first of all works on developing the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, an unobstructed resolve to strive for the ultimate welfare of all beings.
Manjushri, a sparrow chick that has broken through the egg membrane but is not yet fully hatched, being still held within the cracking shell, utters its sparrow cry. Just so, Manjushri, a bodhisattva still held in delusion and yet to emerge from the shell of the triple world, utters the cry of a Buddha, a cry of emptiness, unconditioned and unconfined.
A bodhisattva follows the path of the six perfections. This starts with giving, including specifically fearlessness. Secondly, ethics, with a constant awareness of the meaning of it, which is to realize the bodhicitta. Thirdly, patience, which means not only putting up with things, it means also taking on the truth of things, even when the truth threatens to overwhelm one. Fourthly, energy, an indispensable quality in the face of the task before him. Fifthly, integrated concentration of mind, or samadhi, through meditation. And finally, wisdom, seeing the emptiness of all the ways in which the mind constructs the world. One becomes a bodhisattva by making the four great vows.
However innumerable are living beings, I vow to deliver them. However inexhaustible are the passions, I vow to extinguish them. However immeasurable are the teachings, I vow to master them. However incomparable is the Buddha truth, I vow to attain it.
3. Skillful means, the visual arts. The third main principle of the Mahayana was skillful means. That is, it was prepared to do anything to help people to enlightenment. This idea arose out of a fundamental difference in attitude towards the Buddha's teaching. The Mahayana looked to the teaching offered by the Buddha's life and example as much as to that provided by what he is supposed actually to have said. Buddhist art, for example, aimed to recreate a sense of the Buddha's presence. And this led to a release of the imagination in the search for fresh ways to realize the enlightened mind. It began to make use of religious imagery, and even deities, nature spirits, and demons that might seem to be totally opposed to Buddhist principles. Somehow these were converted, turned into mythic bodhisattvas. This was, in a sense, very much the Buddha's own approach. He would speak to people in their own terms and just redefine those terms. The written word, the sutras. Skillful means also involved a more idealized conception of what constituted the word of the Buddha. In order to be able to make the bodhisattva vow, one's perspective on things, and especially on oneself, had to be stretched beyond all its limits. This was where the Mahayana scriptures come in. The Mahayanists took an essentially inclusive attitude not only to the Sangha, but also to the Dharma. Their scriptures included all the sutras of the Pali canon, but they were prepared to accept as the word of the Buddha anything that did the same job. It is not known to what extent the Mahayana sutras represented the actual teachings of the historical Buddha. Some of them certainly appeared in writing at about the same time as the Pali canon, but they are certainly not represented as being delivered by a leathery-faced, foot-sore old mendicant. The first thing to notice about the major ones is that they are very long. Some, like perhaps the most famous of them, and one of the earliest, the White Lotus Sutra, are regarded as full presentations of the whole of the Dharma. And as the Dharma spread, schools would arise that were based upon just one of these. The Nichiren Shoshu school, for example, which is one of the fastest growing in the world today, regards the White Lotus Sutra as the ultimate Buddhist teaching. The Mahayana sutras, like the archetypal bodhisattvas who inhabit them, belong not in our own world, but beyond space and time. The settings are often the same to begin with, but everything is magically transformed. They take place on a mythical level, where anything can happen. The whole of space and the whole of time are available to the Buddha who preaches these sutras. The Dharma is taught in any way that will stop the listener from thinking they can grasp it intellectually. It is taught through parables, myths, paradox, and symbols. The best-known parable of the White Lotus Sutra is one that compares the Buddha to a great rain cloud. the same rain of the Dharma falls on all alike. But it enables each individual to grow in his or her own individual way, just as the same rain develops both oak trees and rose bushes. The Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. The Diamond Sutra. A very different approach comes from perhaps the most important literary tradition of the Mahayana, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. These make use of paradox to engage the ordinary everyday mind and then ultimately pulverize it as it attempts to get to grips with their meaning. They arose in reaction to the assumption of the Theravada students of Abhidharma that their analysis actually described reality, rather than helping them to realize it. The Abhidharma was like an office that gets obsessed with generating new filing systems. From the Mahayana perspective, it lost track of the point. The earliest of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras appeared in about 100 BC, but they also have a mythical origin. The Buddha is said to have given this teaching to the serpent king of the Nagas, who live in the depths of the ocean, to be kept until someone should appear who would be able to expound it. Eventually, the great Indian philosopher, Nagarjuna, who lived in the 2nd century AD, was presented with it by a Naga princess. One of the most revered of these sutras is the Diamond Sutra. In fact, the earliest printed book in the world is a Chinese translation of it. The opening teaching in this work speaks of the inconceivable union of wisdom and compassion.
Subhuti, one who has taken up the way of the Bodhisattva, should develop a thought like this. As many beings of whatever kind there are in the universe, I should help all of them to nirvana. And yet, when unnumbered beings have thus been liberated, no being whatsoever has been liberated. Why is this? Because a bodhisattva who grasps the notion of a being, of a separate, individualized self or a soul, is not a bodhisattva.
The will to enlightenment of the bodhisattva is a little like the spirit in which one needs to play a sport. While one plays, one always retains the knowledge that it is a game, and thus ultimately a striving for nothing. And yet one plays the game as if winning were the most important thing in the world. Indeed, there is no experience of the game without playing it as if it were not a game. So the famous final lines of the Diamond Sutra should not be understood as meaning that the Bodhisattva doesn't take the game of working in the world towards enlightenment absolutely seriously.
The world you see is thus to be considered, like stars at dawn. Mirages, guttering lamps, a sleight of hand, a dewdrop, or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash, or drifting clouds.
The Heart Sutra. The best loved of all Mahayana sutras is the Heart Sutra, which dates with the Diamond Sutra from about 400 AD. It is recited daily by Buddhists all over the world.
Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, was coursing in the meditative wisdom that has gone beyond. He looked down and saw the categories of which beings were composed, and he saw that those categories were themselves empty. Hear then, Shariputra, form is but emptiness. Emptiness, but form. Feeling, perception, choice, and consciousness are likewise but emptiness. All things are of the nature of emptiness, which does not arise or pass away, which is neither defiled nor pure, neither imperfect nor complete. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness is no form, feeling, perception, choice, or consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No object seen, heard, smelled, tasted, touched, or seized by the mind, nor any sensing of that object. No delusion is there, nor end of it, nor all the round of birth and death that comes from it, nor any stopping of this birth and death. No suffering is there, nor origin of suffering, nor cessation, nor path leading to the cessation of suffering. There is no wisdom to attain, nor non-attainment of wisdom. Therefore, Shariputra, it is by clinging to nothing, holding to no idea of attainment, but dwelling in perfect wisdom, free of distractions, and unperturbed in that freedom, that the Bodhisattva prevails and sustains Nirvana. All Buddhas of the past and present and future accomplish full and supreme awakening by means of the perfection of wisdom. Hear then the great mantra of Prajna Paramita, radiant and unequaled, that abates all suffering. Receive its truth. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, Bodhisvaha. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, Bodhisvaha. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, Bodhisvaha.
Gate, gate, paragate.
Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone wholly beyond. Awakening. All is well.
The Heart Sutra is a concise expression of the concept of emptiness, or shunyata. The idea of emptiness, or shunyata, does not mean that life is empty and meaningless. It is not something beyond or behind the world, nor is it literally a void. It is about coming to the world with empty hands. It is about letting go of the past, of who one is, and of what one knows. It is about letting go of the future, of hopes and fears. It might be supposed that this leaves one in the present moment, but in fact the present too is empty. The doctrine of emptiness is not a statement about what we think of as objective reality. It is an attitude of mind that is to be cultivated.